Hi, guys. Just a reminder that this podcast, as well as many of my online resources, is delivered freely. If you would like to help me get this message of healing out to millions of people around the world, please consider clicking on the donate button on my website, thecureforchronicpain.com. Thank you. Hello, hello, hello. What's up? Hey guys, this is Nicole. Welcome to my podcast, The Cure for Chronic Pain. How are you doing? Are you on a walk? Are you laying in bed? Are you driving in your car? What is up? For me, what is up is East Coast, a million degree hot and humid weather every day. And if you guys follow me on Instagram, you know that the other night on the bike trail, I was taking a sunset bike ride and just loving it, my music in my ears, cruising down the bike trail, and a small light brown bunny, very cute, just jumped into my path, and I swerved left, and I skidded, and I fell hard on my right shoulder and just road rashed the whole bottom of my right arm, my elbow. And it's really funny because I have a very distinct memory of as I was falling, I went, "Bunny!" And I just hit the ground really hard. And I was bleeding down my arm. It was a whole event. And I ended up in the emergency room for 4 hours during COVID, which is, you know, more time consuming and somewhat stressful. I live in a beach town. We do not have a great deal of coronavirus in our area. So it wasn't as severe as it would be maybe in a city, but definitely was no fun. But I am healing, so thank you. Thank you for all the well wishes I have received after I posted on Instagram. I really appreciate it. And I'm doing okay. You know, the one thing that I will say is it's really important to manage our disappointments. Life is not always going to go as you plan. And as my mother always says, the reason they call it an accident is because you did not know it was going to happen. So I'm managing myself and I'm doing well. Today, I bring you a fantabulous interview with Dr. David Clark, one of the foremost experts on TMS in the world. He operates out of Portland, Oregon, and he is the president of the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association. If I had use of my shoulder, I would pat myself on the back for saying that correctly. He's also the assistant director at the Center for Ethics and the clinical assistant professor of gastroenterology, both at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon. And he wrote the book, They Can't Find Anything Wrong. And he also is the lead editor for a professional textbook, Psychophysiologic Disorders, which has 16 contributors from 5 countries. He's lectured extensively on psychophysiologic disorders to healthcare professionals and the public across North America and in Europe, and has appeared on over 100 television and radio broadcasts throughout the U.S. So Dr. Clark is the bomb. I have admired his work for years, and since we met in New York City at the premiere of All the Rage, which is the documentary on Dr. Sarno's life and work, we have followed each other's careers and finally made time to talk on this podcast. We never were able to really talk extensively and connect, and we got to do so here, and it was just wonderful. You know, a lot of people reach out to me and they say, you know, I have this, I have that, I have this, I have that. I don't know if my condition or symptoms or disorder falls under the umbrella of TMS, and they seek out a TMS physician. And this is what Dr. Clark did for years when he was in private practice. He no longer is in private practice. He is similar to me, creating curriculum and taking his efforts on the road. And so basically he seeks to educate the professional community where I seek to educate the patient community, but we really are doing the exact same thing, which is trying to enlighten people on how to heal themselves and heal others from TMS. And so people write to me and they say, you know, maybe I need to see a TMS doctor. And And oftentimes, just for the purpose of belief, that is really, really helpful, especially also to rule out things that may actually need surgery, you know, like tumors or blood disorders, which need medication, etc. But many, many, many afflictions that fall under the umbrella of TMS end up being really helped by seeing a TMS doctor like Dr. Clark and getting the kind of enlightenment that people do need from the medical community. And so this conversation is really just that. And I think that you will really enjoy it. One last note for all of you guys who have been writing and reaching out and asking to work with me directly. I do have some more spots left, maybe just about halfway full for my September retreat. It is a weekend-long online retreat, September 18th through the 20th. It is very personal. It's very intimate. I am there with you the entire time. I bring along all my guest instructors from Omega who bring information and lessons that are incredibly valuable. And it really is a way to work with me. And it's the only way to work directly with me because I'm no longer in a private practice. So if you are interested in that, go to my website, thecurefochronicpain.com, click on the retreats tab. You can learn everything you need to know. All my instructors' bios are there. And it'll be great. I would really love to spend the weekend with you. Our last one in June was fantastic. And if you need anything else, if you want to look at any of my resources, a link to my book, a link to my online community, my YouTube channel, just click on the resources tab at thecurefochronicpain.com. And please do follow me on Instagram at Nicole Sachs, LCSW. So much helpful information there. And my IGTV series, a new episode drops every Monday called I Am Evidence. All right, my lovey loves, I hope this finds you well. Enjoy my interview with Dr. David Clark. Welcome, Dr. David Clark.
Great to be here, Nicole.
Thank you so much for coming to chat with me today. I'm super excited for this conversation. I have wanted to connect with you for quite a while, and so I'm really glad that we can spend this time together today.
Yeah, you and I share a lot of ideas, I know.
Yes. And actually, if you probably recall this, I definitely do. The first time that we met, we were standing on the street of New York City, and it was during the first premiere of All the Rage, and you came to me and you said, "It's too bad so much of your stuff was cut out of the film." Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. I met a lot of people that night. It was a kind of a gathering of almost, you know, everybody I know that works in this field, and so it was a great experience. But yeah, I remember meeting you, and that you and I have come to so many of the same conclusions over the years about what's happening to people with stress related illness. So it was great to actually meet you in person for the first time.
Awesome. Yeah. I just remember also being excited that there were people with so many similar thoughts, because at the time, several years ago, there weren't many talking about it.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, I did this work starting in 1983, and as far as I could tell, it was in nearly complete isolation. I didn't know that there were people from the full spectrum of the healthcare profession that had found their way to very similar ideas about how to help people with this condition, even though we all started from very different places. I mean, I'm a gastroenterologist, you're a psychotherapist, and, you know, how much more opposite could we be in the spectrum? And yet we've had a meeting of the minds.
Absolutely. So, Dave, what I am interested in hearing about is how this began for you. So you said the early 80s was when you were really starting to come into this. And I, as you know, worked very closely with Dr. Sarno for many years before he retired. And I'm so well acquainted with the frustration that he felt about knowing how he could help people and feeling so ostracized and so shut down by the medical community in general. So just, I'm fascinated to hear kind of your story a bit and how you kind of get into this and how's it been for you?
Well, it started when I was in training to become a gastroenterologist, and I was on a pathway toward being a garden variety medical specialist. And then I ran into a patient who had a severe collection of symptoms. She was referred to us from another university because they couldn't figure out what was wrong. And we couldn't figure out what was wrong either. We offered some very specialized testing that was perfectly normal in her case, as had every other test that she'd been through. And I was doing an exit interview with her and trying desperately to think of what else we might offer for her severe 2 years worth of illness, and stumbled on the fact that she'd been severely abused as a girl. Nobody had touched her against her will for 25 years, but she was telling me this story about this terrible thing that had happened to her repeatedly. And I didn't know if that was in any way connected to her illness. I didn't think it possibly could be, but there was a psychiatrist that I was aware of, didn't know, but was aware of, that did mind-body work at UCLA where I was in training. And I connected the two of them and promptly forgot all about it and moved on with my, you know, ulcers and gallstones and liver disease and all the other things that I was doing, until I ran into the psychiatrist in an elevator one day and, just to make conversation, asked her what happened to this very mysterious patient, and was shocked to learn that the patient had been cured by, you know, less than 3 months worth of weekly counseling sessions. And that completely shocked me. There was it's a little bit embarrassing to admit this as a physician, but I'd gone through 7 years of formal education without anyone ever telling me that it was possible to alleviate somebody's symptoms, especially serious ones, just by talking to them. How do you do that? So I invited Dr. Kaplan, Harriet Kaplan, to sit in with us in our outpatient clinic, to see if there might be some other cases out there that might have similar issues. And sure enough, we started to find them. And she started to explain, you know, what her approach was. And that was my beginning. And it was only a framework. And I was disappointed to find, when I started practice in Portland, Oregon in 1984, that there weren't any Harriet Kaplans hereabouts. And I pretty much had to sink or swim. So I began doing the best that I could, a lot of trial and error, and it took me, you know, hundreds of interviews over a period of several years before my learning curve finally reached a decent level. But I've been at it ever since. It's been about a third of my practice, over 7,000 patients, and I learned from them. I learned how to pursue this form of illness to its source, and I think, you know, I followed a path, you know, similar to the one that you did. You had to trace in your own life and in your patients the root cause of all this, and it took me a while. People don't recognize all of the issues that are underneath the surface, and because of that, they can't formally tell you straight out what's happening with them. You have to be intuitive. You have to be empathic, and it takes experience. So it was a painful struggle to figure out what was happening to people. But once I got there, the results I was getting were wonderful. They were very rewarding. You'd see people improve who had been ill for years in many cases. And most of my colleagues were very supportive, unlike Dr. Sarno's experience. I got a lot of support, people sending me patients. They even gave me the Doctor of the Year award. I worked for an organization with hundreds of doctors, and, you know, to get the Doctor of the Year award, which was usually given to a senior member of the group, and I had only been working there 6 years, and I got this award. That was hugely validating.
Right.
I did get some pushback. People would say, you know, you're not doing as many colonoscopies as some of your colleagues are, but I just pointed out, well, you know, the patients I'm seeing are second opinions. They've already had a colonoscopy. They don't need another one. And so they pretty much left me alone after that and let me do my thing. So I had a much more positive experience, I'll say, than Dr. Sarno, whom I hadn't heard of at that point. You know, he was in New York, and he was doing back pain, and I was doing gastrointestinal symptoms for the most part. So I didn't find out about him until 2008, and saw, you know,
wow,
here's an example of somebody who has followed the same path, who was trained in one way, you know, an organ focused, you know, body physiology focused form of medicine, and who's found his way to the psychological and the importance of it, the critical importance of it for so many patients. And then there was a conference in 2009 that was put together by Dr. Schubiner and Dr. Strax, whom many of your listeners will know or have heard of. And
oh yeah,
50 of us gathered in Ann Arbor, Michigan for a conference, and each of us got 20 or 30 minutes to talk about where we had come from and what we had learned. And, you know, it was person after person after person sharing their journey to the same, you know, it was like rivers that all start in different mountains, all coming down to the same lake and reaching the same conclusions. It was absolutely a revelation to hear that so many people had followed the same path that I had. So I had, like I say, a much more positive experience than Dr. Sarno. I was much more accepted in my environment. And the rewards of doing this work, as you know, are fantastic.
Oh, yeah. Well, first of all, I just want to say that that makes me so happy because, you know, because I came up with Dr. Sarno and was so connected to him emotionally, I do have a bit of a dark cloud that can hang over me about how, you know, there's only so much progress that can ever be made because this is so hard. And I think that personally, I need to step more into my power when it comes to that, because I think I carry a lot of the burden of his devastation. And I don't use that word lightly, of how difficult it was for him being 50 years at Rusk Center for Rehabilitation at NYU Medical Center and never getting a referral from inside the building. You know, can you imagine?
You know, it is such a burden not to have the support of your colleagues. I emphasized in my group a team spirit, you know, from the person who checked people in at the front desk to the nursing staff, to the physician staff, that I wanted us, you know, we met monthly, you know, everybody. And it required the cooperation and the understanding of everybody in our office to achieve the best outcomes, because the person at the front desk, you know, might hear a patient say something that would provide a critical clue to right. what was happening to them. And my nurses, they got so good at understanding what was happening to my patients with stress-related physical symptoms that just in putting the patient in the room and chatting with them and taking their blood pressure and their other vital signs, and they would hear things and they would pass them along because they understood the significance. So that team spirit was so important. And, you know, to work without that, the isolation of that, just a tremendous burden. And I feel for Dr. Sarno that he had to put up with that.
Yes, yes. And I think that the general thing we're talking about here is belief, you know, belief in the medical community, belief within each patient that empowers them to heal. So I would love to talk about that a bit. So all of my listeners hear this, and I'm sure you've heard me say it at some point, which is there's three facets to the work I do with people: believe, do the work, and patience and kindness for yourself. And do the work is something, you know, journal speak. I'm always obviously talking about that. But considering that you have worked so many years as the physician, help me to help people understand how to believe, because even it is so ingrained in our psyche, those of us who have been brought up in the Western medical model, that a physical pain requires a physical solution, that I find that even people who are smart and educated and informed, and even people who have seen the proof in their own body, meaning they had debilitating back pain, they did the work, they had a period of cessation of that pain, when it comes back, they still say to me, maybe I need another MRI, or, you know, whatever equivalent test would be for the illness that they have. So what slant do you take on that when you're trying to help people come into that alignment with their full belief? Because I think it is such an integral part of healing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, as I say, I try to trace the roots of this illness back to the source as much as I can, and then clarify that for people. Maybe I can express this best by saying that, you know, the name of the nonprofit that I chair is the Psychophysiologic Disorders Association. And the physiology that's involved here is a change in the anatomy of people's brains. In this form of illness, there are numerous studies now that show that the circuits in the brain are different than they are in healthy people, in people who don't have this form of illness. So what we're trying, you know, so this really is a physical illness. This really is a physiologic condition, no different in principle than any other form of illness, you know, an organ disease or a structural abnormality, for example. So what we're trying to do in treating this condition is to physically change that neuroanatomy. So how do we do that? Well, we want people to understand the root cause of it, which for a majority of my patients was experience that they had in childhood. And it has to do with a couple of things. And you know this from you know, your work with JournalSpeak. JournalSpeak is doing exactly the same thing that I try to do with my patients, which is to help them understand, you know, what did you learn about yourself as a child that isn't true? What mm-hmm. emotions did you experience as a child that have been locked away and you're not having access to them today? What personality features did you acquire as a kid that helped you survive as a kid, but which are not serving you well today? And, you know, to summarize those three areas, I do a thought experiment with my patients, which is to ask them to imagine that they're a, and there are variations on this, but ask them to imagine that they're a butterfly on the wall of their childhood home, and they are having to watch their own children, or a child that they care about if they don't have one of their own, but they're watching their own children try to cope with the same childhood environment that they grew up in, and they're not able to do anything about it. They're a butterfly on the wall. They're confined to just sitting there and watching what's happening to their kids. And this, you know, if this is an ugly, painful thought experiment to put somebody through, but it's really important, because when people look back at their own lives, they don't have a parallel life to compare to, and they tend to minimize the suffering that they experienced. I've had countless patients say, you know, it wasn't that bad. And, you know, other people have been through much worse than what I went through. And, you know, I've dealt with it. It's in the past. I'm not having to go there anymore. But when they think about their own kid trying to cope with, you know, even for just a week or two, trying to cope with that same early environment that they had to put up with, then all of a sudden, you know, there's a revelation about that. And they're going, oh, my gosh, not for 5 minutes would I want to watch my kid have to put up with what I did. And you know, my patients typically put up with these environments for, you know, 18 years. So, you know, if they were forced to watch it happen for a week, well, they did it for 1,000 weeks, you know, more or less. So that helps people to recognize the magnitude of what they had to endure and overcome. And that does a number of things. It first of all, it connects them with some emotions that maybe they haven't personally experienced before. But it also helps them to recognize what it took to come through that. I like my patients to think of themselves as heroic, because that's mm-hmm. exactly what they are. A hero in our society is somebody who overcame a difficult mental or physical challenge for a good cause. And my patients who have survived a dysfunctional family or an abusive family, they've done exactly that. And they come out of it typically thinking of themselves as second-rate, you know, pieces of crap, frankly. That's what the dysfunctional, abusive environments do to kids. It makes them feel like no matter how perfect they are, no matter how hard they work, no matter how detailed or perfect or energetic they are, that it's never going to be enough, that they're never going to be good enough. And I want them to feel like they are Olympic champion weightlifters of stress, and that they've been carrying, you know, hundreds of pounds of stress around for their entire lives, and that that makes them heroic, and that if we can put that stress down, that they're, the strength that they have, the all the good qualities, the compassion, the reliability, the attention to detail, the kindness, will all still be there. But the stress will finally be set down. And once you, you know, if you've been carrying hundreds of pounds of stress around your whole life and you finally set it down, all of a sudden you feel your strength and your power and all the good qualities that, that you forged during those early years will all still be there. And it's, you've taken a big step on the pathway toward becoming the person you were always meant to be. So that's kind of, you know, my approach. I try to encourage people to think of this as a process of changing their own physiology, changing their own neuroanatomy, to thinking of themselves as heroic is having its impact on those circuits that have been creating your symptoms.
So let me ask you something, because your this conversation is making me think about people who come to me, whether it's actually or virtually, and say, okay, you know, I hear what Dr. Clark is saying. That makes a lot of sense for some people, but I had a happy childhood. I get that a lot. So how do you help people understand that this applies to all of us, even if we had a, quote, happy childhood?
Well, a few people, the source of the issue wasn't in their childhood. I mean, I have to concede that there may have been a more recent trauma that they experienced. And so I look for that. And a few people there have undergone some kind of biological change in their central nervous system that has produced anxiety or depression that doesn't have a strong link to the past. So there are a few people like that that genuinely can't come up with any adversity that they experienced when they were kids. But the majority of people who tell me that their childhood was fine, when we begin to talk about it in more detail,
right,
we begin to uncover that not everything was quite as rosy as they think it was. Because, you know, again, we don't have a parallel life to compare it with. And we tend to accept, you know, whatever we went through as kids as being, you know, more or less normal. And the emotions that we might have felt as kids may have long since been repressed. So what I'm looking for in somebody who really insists that everything was fine is a treatment of the kid that is well-intentioned, that the parents have, you know, no thought but the benefit for their child, the for their child to be the best person they can possibly be. And so they're looking basically, when you think about your own kid, you can always think of a way in which your child might be able to do something better. I mean, you know, 5-10 times a day, you can, as an adult, look at what your kid is doing and see a way that they could improve how they're doing things. And if that gets pointed out to you as a kid 5 or 10 times a day, you know, it's well-intentioned. You're trying to, you know, help your kid improve themselves. But the message that you're sending is, oh, here's another example of how you didn't do something well enough to, you know, to please me. And, you know, if you get that message over and over and over again, it's putting you in that same place of not measuring up, of not being as good as you could be, of not being good enough, frankly. And that has a long-term impact. That kind of subtle pressure on a person adds up over time and gets people on a treadmill that they have difficulty getting off. And they try harder and harder to be perfect and reliable and detail-oriented and good. And their parent, if their parent has this way of behaving, you know, no matter how high you jump, the parent just kind of moves, you know, the parent in this particular kind of case moves the bar up. So you jump right. over one bar and you find the next time the bar is even higher. And after a while, people are like, you know, what do I have to do to get a little respect around here? And the long-term impact of that, and this took me a while to appreciate, but the long-term impact on a person's life is very similar to the long-term impact from people who were out and out abused. And it surprised me a lot, but there was very little difference in people and anybody who was made to feel like a second-rate human being. It didn't matter so much how they were made to feel that way.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it could even be even more subtle. So, of course, the most obvious is if you were overtly abused. Next step down is if you had a parent, which, by the way, you just told the story of my childhood, which is I had a dad who thought that it probably was best for all of us, best for his mental health and mine, for me to be perfect, because wouldn't everyone just be so happy? And so I was reminded often and corrected often, you know, yes, I know you did it, but this is how it could be a little bit better. And, you know, why don't you think about it this way? And how about you think this? And how about you get interested in this? And you're right. I mean, the subtlety of the constant correction does make you feel like there's everywhere you turn, there's a bear trap. So then there's that childhood. But then there's even a more subtle one that I've been finding lately in my interviews with people, because I do this thing on the podcast called Real Time Heal, where I bring people on who I've never met, never spoken to, and we do a session right here on the podcast. And they're amazing experiences for both of us. And one of the ones recently I did with a woman named Clara, is she was talking about how she just wasn't an emotional match with her mother, that she was very sensitive and very acutely aware, very vigilant, and her mother just didn't relate. So her mom kept trying to help her, and she said she would sit with me and she would be with me, but it made me feel more alone because it was so obvious that she didn't get who I was. And so it's I like to help people understand it doesn't, you know, childhood issues don't mean that your parents were total jerks and wanted the worst for you. It could even mean that just their very nature didn't connect with you and left you feeling alone. So it can get very complicated.
Yeah, absolutely. It a lot of my patients, particularly adolescents, have come from homes where there was a problem, an issue, oftentimes from outside the family that created a difficulty, and everybody in the family was doing their best, but the doing their best resulted in a great deal of pressure on the person who eventually became my patient. And nobody at the time really necessarily appreciated how much pressure was being generated, but it had the same, you know, long-term impact. And I'm thinking about one of my patients whose mother had been a caregiver growing up, you know, even as an eight-year-old, this woman had been a caregiver in the family. And then my patient developed a juvenile diabetes, and the patient's mother was instantly back in that caregiver role and became what we call a helicopter parent, you know, always hovering over mm-hmm. her juvenile diabetic child, which was, you know, okay and necessary and certainly well-intentioned at the age of 9, but it hadn't changed a bit at the age of 17. And, you know, that 17-year-old had no space in which to grow because mom was all over every detail of the patient's life as much at 17 as she had been at 9. And that was, you know, again, well-intentioned, but it was an enormous amount of pressure. And it was also sending a message that, you know, you're not capable of managing your own illness. So it had those elements of pressure and of making the patient feel like a second-rate person, and it produced a profound level of illness. I was consulted on that patient after she'd been in the hospital for 10 straight weeks.
Wow. So How is it when you get into contact with these? So you meet someone and they are obviously in a space totally in the physical, I would imagine.
Yes.
How do you begin to help them move to this incredibly groundbreaking work?
Well, one of the techniques that I teach, particularly in my medical audiences, is to bring up the possibility of stress being involved in someone's illness right at the start. You know, even on the very first visit with someone, where I'm talking to them about there could be inflammation, there could be a gallstone, there could be an ulcer, there could be a disc problem, you know, whatever it is. But, you know, I'll include on the list of possibilities that there could be stress, and that I'll talk to them a little bit about what those stresses might be. And there's much greater acceptance of this possibility when it's just one amongst many. And I'm including organ diseases and structural abnormalities. And people appreciate what I'm doing there, which is to be holistic, to include right. the full spectrum of possibilities. And just by asking a few questions along the lines of what I call a stress evaluation, where I'm systematically going through all the different types of stresses that are capable of making someone physically ill, it gets people thinking. And if I'm hearing back from them that, yes, there are some stressful issues going on, I'll ask them to make a list of all the stresses that they've had in their life. And I know you do this in your work as well, both past and present, all the stresses from the past as well as the ones that are going on right now. And, you know, the act of writing those down, as you very well know, gets people thinking. And oftentimes, once people start writing these ideas, they write a lot more than they might have guessed they would. And it starts a process of not only self-discovery, but also can lead to people thinking, well, maybe I should reduce my stress in a couple of these areas. Maybe I should do a few things in my life or change a few things to reduce the stress level. Because after all, the doctor has raised this as a possible cause of my symptoms. And while I'm undergoing diagnostic tests for some other things, I can work on this stress idea. And not infrequently when they come back, you know, I'm usually have scheduled them for a diagnostic test that I perform myself. So they'll come back after a couple of weeks for that test. And they often will tell me that their symptoms are making progress just in relation to what they've done around their stress. So that improves their confidence that pursuing the stress angle is the right way to go. So it's kind of grows organically from my diagnostic process.
And how quickly, or do you tell people that it would be great to work with a therapist? Because a lot of the people who contact me from around the world say to me, you know, I feel like I need a therapist to do this. And sometimes that's a very, they're very upset because they feel like they can't afford it. And so it tends to be something that I know people struggle with, you know, can this be done alone? And I do my very best to put out as many resources as I can to support people in doing it on their own. But in terms of your experience, do you recommend that people see a therapist?
It depends a great deal on the patient. You know, as you know, some people can get tremendous relief from their symptoms simply from reading a book. And then other people, they may need to read several books, or there's also now the Curable app, which wasn't available when I was in practice. So that's a very valuable resource for a lot of people, packs a tremendous amount of mind-body ideas into a good user interface. But absolutely, there are people that need to interact with a therapist that understands these concepts. And unfortunately, there are limitations in just the sheer numbers of people that understand the kinds of issues that are active in mind-body illness. Cognitive behavioral therapy has taken over large swaths of the psychotherapeutic profession. And for most of my patients, yeah, that hasn't been enough. The CBT tends to focus on helping people cope with their illness, but not so much getting to the root causes. And so what I'll often try to do with the patients who need this kind of help is, because I can't control who they get to see as a therapist in my particular practice environment. So I'll spend time working with them on the deeper issues, the, you know, oftentimes the family of origin issues, and get those enough into their consciousness and give them some, you know, reading resources and other ideas to help them get started with that, so that when they do go see a therapist, they will have those root cause type concerns uppermost in their mind and be able to present those to the therapist. And then it's my hope that the therapist will take that and run with it and be able to make a difference. Because, you know, early in my career, I sent lots of people off to therapy here in my community, and lots of them came right back because what they got was CBT and it wasn't enough. There unfortunately weren't any Harriet Kaplan's here in Oregon where I was practicing. And you know, if there were, I probably never would have gone as far in this field as I have, because those patients wouldn't have come back to see me. So, yeah, I mean, I recommend therapy a lot for people, but I try to get them to a good place before they start. You know, give them a solid platform of information that they can use as a starting point with a therapist, and that works out a lot better.
And for those of you who are listening and who haven't heard of CBT, I'll just give a quick primer. Cognitive behavioral therapy is a therapeutic modality where it's kind of like you're taught how to have certain behaviors that you use in stressful situations to cope and get you through that situation, you know, in terms of mindset and breathing and planning. And, you know, just it's very concrete. And I think what Dr. Clark and I are both acknowledging is it doesn't allow fully felt experiences from the past or the way that your current life is triggering you into those tender places to be felt, because really it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on top of that so you can get through that hour. And this is not to say that we don't need tools to get through our hours, because we do. But, you know, one thing I want to say to everybody out there is if you are seeing a therapist and if you just think the person could be open to this kind of work, it's good to self-advocate. It's good to bring this information, you know, recommend that they listen to this podcast, recommend that they take a look at, you know, one of Dr. Sarno's books, or maybe read up on the Curable app, because I really believe that if therapists knew more about the efficacy of this kind of work, they would be on board with it. I just think that, you know, we're still at the point where we're trying to bring that information to the fore.
Yeah, absolutely. At the PPD Association, we created an online course as well, just because there's such a great need in the psychotherapeutic community as well as the medical community to acquire these ideas and skills. I mean, even the basic idea that psychosocial stress can cause real physical symptoms that are every bit as severe and every bit as long-lasting as symptoms caused by organ disease and structural abnormalities, even that basic idea that stress can do that to a person is lacking throughout the medical profession, and, you know, in the mental health profession as well. They typically don't train mental health professionals what to do for someone with a physical symptom, because that's regarded as belonging to the medical profession. And the medical profession thinks that if there's not an organ disease or a structural abnormality, that doesn't belong to them. So the end result is we've got 40 million people in the United States alone, about 1 in 6 adults, that fall into this giant blind spot of unnecessary suffering.
Yes. Absolutely. So, Dr. Clark, I know that you mentioned right before we jumped on air that you are no longer seeing private patients. Is that correct?
That's right. I occasionally will get referrals from psychotherapists that I know who are asking me to have a one-time conversation with one of their clients. And I'm happy to do that. But that's pretty much the only way that I'm seeing people nowadays. I you know, after 7,000 patients one-on-one, I decided the best use of my time and what I had learned was to educate others. So along with a bunch of other people, we created the PPD Association, and I spend my time teaching healthcare professionals all across North America and Europe.
So the PPD Association is just, you're not teaching laymen, you're not teaching patients, you're teaching professionals in order to help patients.
That's our main focus, because when we can educate one healthcare professional, we've changed that person's practice for the rest of their career, and we've leveraged our impact. We do occasional presentations for the public. You know, when I'm invited to, I definitely do that. But I feel like the best use of our time is to educate healthcare professionals, because that changes their practice, and it spreads the word in a way that when ideally at some point the entire healthcare profession will accept this form of intervention just as they do everything else that they're currently practicing.
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I'm incredibly grateful for your work, because this is where it's at. You know, if you're going to change the world, you do it from both the bottom up and the top down, you know, as much as possible. Where I stand, I'm in the, you know, the trenches of the grassroots. I'm trying to tell each person out there, how long do you want to suffer? You know, are you done? Are you ready to be done? Because then we have some tools for you, and you're bringing it from the top down. So I'm curious about your role with Curable. So as you may know, Curable sponsors this podcast. I are tremendously grateful for their work and their offerings, because as I say often, you know, from where I'm standing and what I'm doing, I can't do it alone. And so to be able to refer someone to an app that is there for them every day, that can help direct their thinking, is just incredibly valuable. And one of the best things that I've found in Curable is the explanation of the brain science. So I don't actually know the answer to this question. Were you part of creating it?
Creating it, no, but I was probably their first outside scientific advisor. Their CEO reached out to me. I spend a lot of time in Denver, and he had just moved to Denver. And so we started meeting at a coffee shop on a regular basis and just talking about what he was working on and sharing ideas. And, you know, initially the app was created to help people with migraines. And one of my contributions was to encourage him to open that up to physical symptoms that of any kind that were not explained by an organ disease or a structural abnormality, because the roots of those symptoms are pretty much all the same. You'll see on the forums and even in public presentations that I do, that people will raise their hands and say, I've got symptoms X, Y, and Z, and could this be PPD or TMS? And the answer is, yeah, it certainly could be in almost all cases. But the answer is to explore the roots of it, as we've discussed, you know, childhood roots and others, and see if by doing that you make progress. But the roots of those symptoms are all, you know, have huge amounts in common. So the Curable app, I encourage them to create it in a way that would be effective for the full spectrum of physical symptoms connected to stress. And also the other contribution that I made was to include more material on the roots in childhood adversity, to give, you know, more writing exercises and meditations that would address that as a source. And they went for that in a big way, and I think it made a big difference to the effectiveness of the app, and it's a tremendous resource. I dearly wish I had had it available to me when I was in practice.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny. I just this morning came from a well check at my daughter. She's 12 years old. It was her 12-year-old visit, and they gave her the ACEs survey. And I was like, yes, you know, this is fantastic that kids are routinely being given this at their 12-year-old check to start to help kids. So if people don't know what ACEs is, it's the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study, and it helps to identify areas in people's lives that could cause trauma, could cause trauma in the moment and then could cause medical issues down the road. Do you actually work directly with that study?
Well, the leader of that study is a physician named Vince Felitti, and he and I are friends and colleagues. I spent a week with him back in the 1990s when he was collecting the data that was eventually published in 1998. And we found we had a tremendous amount in common, because what he was finding in his patients who were just coming in for routine screening was a tremendous amount of ACEs in the background. We used to think that ACEs were relatively uncommon, but he found that of the 10 that he looked for, about one person in six had at least four, which had a tremendous negative impact on their health outcomes later in life. And I was finding exactly the same thing in my patients with physical symptoms that had no explanation in organ disease or structural abnormalities. The two issues with the ACEs questionnaire: one, that it's 10 questions, so it takes a while to administer, and two, it doesn't cover everything. There are childhood adversities that can happen to people that are not specifically asked about in the questionnaire. So what I did in my own practice was I would summarize all the ACEs in one question. And the one question was, if you learned that a child you care about was growing up exactly as you did, how would this make you feel? And I gave people four choices for their answers to that question. It would make them feel happy. It would make them feel neutral. It would make them feel sad or angry. Or it would make them feel very sad or very angry. And the answers to those questions, the four answers, correlated very strongly with the full ACE questionnaire. I mean, there was a linear increase. I studied 200 of my patients, and the people who said they were very sad or very angry when they did that thought experiment had an average ACE score of 7 out of 10.
Wow.
So the other thing I should point out is that when practices incorporate this, as your well child visit did, and I just applaud them no end for doing that, because it's so, right? It's so important. The Nadine Burke Harris TED Talk is something that anybody interested in this should look up on YouTube, because it speaks to this directly. But there's also a benefit to the physicians themselves. This is 30 or 40% of the people that come into a primary care practice that have TMS or PPD, which are synonyms for each other. So imagine, you know, you've had no formal training in this, and 30 or 40% of the patients that are coming in to see you have these unexplained symptoms, no organ disease or structural abnormality to explain it. What are you going to do? You're going to get frustrated. The patient's going to get frustrated. So many of my patients have been to, you know, doctor after doctor with, you know, no good answers and frequently lots of bad answers that have been given to them. But the physicians themselves get, you know, tremendously frustrated by this. They want to help, but they don't know how. And it leads to burnout amongst the medical profession being faced with this day after day. But if you teach people, if you teach physicians how to diagnose and treat this successfully, you know, which we can do in, you know, a matter of hours, it absolutely transforms their practice. And we've seen this happen in numerous locations around the country where the PPD Association has provided training. One family doctor just came up to me and said, I've been using this now for 6 months, and it's brought the joy back into my practice.
Wow. I mean, and this is so important, and it's so great that you bring that up. It's not just that patients are frustrated. Good doctors are frustrated too.
Absolutely.
You know? I mean, the amount of prescription of opioids, you know, it's not everyone out there that is prescribing these medications is some villain who is being paid off by Big Pharma. These are good doctors that don't know what else to do.
They don't know there's a great alternative, exactly.
So I'm so thrilled to hear that. So Dr. Clark, I asked this of most of my interviewees, and I will ask it of you as we round out this interview. So you are looking out in my podcast audience upon many thousands of people that potentially are really suffering, really at a low point, really looking for a beacon of light and of inspiration. So in your many years of experience and also obviously personally interacting with your own body and with others, what advice would you give people if they're laying there and they're just saying, God, these people are talking and it sounds really good and wouldn't it be great, but I don't know, you know, I'm just really low. What would you say to those people?
Well, there is hope. There is absolutely hope. I have seen people in really extreme levels of illness who have turned things around. And it shocked me early on, and occasionally still does, just how ill you can get from various kinds of stress, but also how much improvement people can experience when they're able to trace their illness to its roots. One of my patients was ill for 79 years. And, wow. You know, she was in her late 80s, so she didn't make a 100% recovery, but I would estimate about a 60% recovery over a couple of years, even after such a long time. Another patient of mine, 55 years of illness, volume 3 of his paper chart, because we didn't have electronic records when I saw him, volume 3 alone was 8 centimeters thick. And yet he became completely well in 3 weeks. There's a spectrum of speed of recovery that depends on the severity of the stress that people have suffered and depends on the resilience that they were born with or that they acquired from how they were treated when they were young. So the people that get better quickly are balanced by people who get better slowly. But once you even set 2 feet on this pathway and you see that you get a little bit better, that is so reassuring to people that they have finally begun moving in the right direction, and that further in that direction is restoration of their health. And even more than that, becoming personally the kind of people they were always meant to be. That is just so encouraging for people. One of my patients, you know, after 5 years of psychotherapy, she was maybe 50% improved. And I asked her straight out, I mean, doesn't this just discourage you that it's taken so long to, you know, even get 50% better? And she said, absolutely not. I'm just thrilled. And she pointed out to me that, you know, she had previously been in the hospital multiple times per year. She had previously been on opioids. She was, you know, exceedingly ill. And now, I guess even after 1 year of going down this path, she had stopped needing the hospital. She hadn't been admitted to the hospital in 4 years at that point. She was no longer taking opioids. She'd made what for her was tremendous progress, and she continued to be hopeful that in another 5 years she would reach a point where her illness was done. So that's what I would encourage people, is to leap into this approach, as painful as it can be at the outset. And even though it's often characterized by a 2 steps forward, 1 step back kind of pathway, that as long as you're pushing forward with everything you've got, you're going to get there.
Wow, that is awesome advice. Thank you for that. That's really, it makes me feel good to hear it, because I need sometimes a little shot in the arm of how to keep people going. And that's a really, really great way to phrase it. So Dr. Clark, if people want to learn more about what you're doing in the world, and maybe there's some professionals out there listening that want to get involved, how do they find you?
Well, they can certainly go to the ppdassociation.org website. There's also a website devoted to my first book, which is stressillness.com. And we have a new professional textbook called Psychophysiologic Disorders with the subtitle Trauma-Informed Interprofessional Diagnosis and Treatment. And we deliberately kept the jargon in that textbook to a minimum because we wanted the medical professionals to be able to read the chapters that were written by psychology professionals and vice versa. So that one of the side benefits of that is that people who are not healthcare professionals can also read that textbook and get a lot out of it. But we've got 16 writers from around the world who've contributed to that. So it provides a lot of different perspectives. As I like to express it, it's kind of like you're in a dark room with an elephant and everybody's shining their flashlight on this elephant from a different angle. And with all those different flashlights and all those different angles, you get a pretty good idea of what's in the room.
I love that. You get the whole elephant.
There you go. That's what we're trying for.
Oh, man. We all need the whole elephant, don't we?
Definitely.
Oh, man. Well, Dave, it has been such a pleasure to interview you today. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I love the work that you're doing. And it's great to have more shoulders at the wheel.
Absolutely. We're all in it together and we need all of us.
Yeah, no question about it. We're a minority, but it feels like we're approaching a tipping point, that the science around this is gathering steam. We've now got a bibliography on our website of over 175 references, each of them annotated, that support the work that we're doing. And we didn't have that 20, 30 years ago.
Absolutely. Well, I am grateful for all of that. And thank you for this wonderful conversation. And for all of you guys out there, this has been The Cure for Chronic Pain with me, Nicole Sachs, and we'll see you next week. Bye-bye.